Alan Arkin is starring with Andy Garcia in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. Arkin will be honored October 9th at the Mill Valley Film Festival in California. We have a 1989 interview with Arkin. His earlier films include The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, and Joshua Then and Now. As a director, he did the stage and screen versions of Jules Pfeiffer's Little Murders. His new film, Steal Big, Steal Little, is a Cain and Abel story with Andy Garcia playing both the good and the bad brother. They're twins. Reuben, the good twin, is trying to keep his greedy brother Robbie from stealing his Santa Barbara ranch. Arkin's character, Lou, arrives just in time to give Reuben some advice. Reuben believes history proves he's bound to lose the ranch.
There they are, Lou. Spanish Armada anchored in the harbor, ready to steal the land from the Indians. It's all happened before. The Spanish took it from the Chumash, the gringos from the Mexicans, my brother from me. I'm gonna lose it all.
No, you're not. You don't lose anything until I tell you you lost it.
You know something I don't know?
Yeah, I do. Don't trust your friends, because when they screw you, it'll break your heart.
Can't trust a friend, who can you trust?
A neutral party. Me.
I'll bail you out, but you gotta make me a partner.
You wanna be my partner?
Yeah.
I'd be honored.
In 1989, Alan Arkin told me that before he became an actor, he used to mimic the people he knew.
I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good particularly.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy, who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey. He wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4" and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, him, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater, and when you got, I think it was when you got out of college in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group The Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy?
Yeah.
It seems, it almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I felt so myself. I ended up, after about 2 years, being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing Hearts on It, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel, practically. And I said, who am I? What am I doing here? And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that it would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Alan Arkin is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All to keep in calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. Olna, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey. Just take it easy now, Pete Boyd. Don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please, so that there is no necessity whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
So that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly, and there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
Yeah, I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days. Other gods, mainly no account idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright and made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's... thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right, well, you know, there's Ten Commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right. You're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
on? Not a soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead. That sounds good. And that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, and in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own, and feeling like I'd passed the course, and having him say akin to, I never promised you a rose garden. And I found myself getting furious at that idea, because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it, and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra, so he was playing a stand-in.
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, as mm-hmm. everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. It's not as if he was loud or pushy or taking over anything, but he just radiated something that people gravitated towards. Like one person would be telling him their problems, another person would be asking him for a massage. And I got really quietly enraged by that. And it was, again, nothing that he was attempting to do. He wasn't attempting to run the show in any way. It was very quiet. And if you didn't really look for this, you wouldn't have even noticed it. And it annoyed me. So I said, here I am. I have everything. I'm the star. I got 10 times as much money as he's got. I got more attention. And He's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was a guru. Has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part. I mean,
sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flush, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think, if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Would you like to be working as much as possible or as little as possible?
I love working when it's with people that I'm excited about working with, and it's when it's with projects that are have some redeeming feature about them. Otherwise, I'm just as happy to stay home and write or do nothing. I don't feel a burning need that I've got to act anymore or direct.
What do you do when you're doing nothing?
I'm thinking about writing. when I'm doing nothing.
That's what a lot of writers do, is think about writing. Well, Alan Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
With us.
You're wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much.
Alan Arkin stars in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. He will be the honoree at the Mill Valley Film Festival in California, which begins October 5th. This Sunday on the Showtime cable network, he's featured in the first of the six-part series Picture Windows. His installment is called Soir Bleu. Our interview was recorded in 1989. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air.